In our first story, Behind Mansion Walls, a match made in heaven.
You look at a couple like this and you think they have it all.
Descends into hell.
He had a secret apartment where he was hooking up with guys and cross-dressing.
And later.
Late nights, lots of cocaine, lots of champagne, lots of drugs around.
She was young, he was rich, and their marriage was doomed.
You know, where goes drugs, where goes money laundering, death sometimes is soon to follow.
I'm Christopher Mason. It's the promise every marriage is built on. Husbands and wives vowing to love each other till death do us part. Behind mansion walls, death can strike sooner than you expect.
Newburgh, in upstate New York. Police here have been called to a dumpster.
What do we got here?
Whoa.
At a local car wash.
Nice. This would look good on you, sir.
The car wash cleaner found identification for a small, thin woman. She was 5'3" and barely 100 pounds.
When the police officers went into that dumpster, it showed credit cards and personal belongings, jewelry.
The name on the license is Diane Peichel, age 44, of Greenwich Village, New York City. And right now, back in Manhattan, Diane's friends are wondering where she is.
Diane was missing. Her friends were calling. Where was she?
It was not like Diane Peichel to not show up or call to work Monday morning.
And there's another strange thing about the clothes in that dumpster.
Check this, size 11, she must be huge.
Oddly enough, there were a lot of clothes for like a humongous woman, a woman who was as big as 6 foot tall and wore size 30 clothes or something.
Can't be this woman then, she's only 5'3".
What a curious find. The clothes of a petite woman from New York City who's now reported missing, together with the clothes of another rather large woman. What does she have to do with the disappearance of Diane Peichel?
Diane Peichel has been living a glamorous life among the glittering towers of Manhattan.
She was absolutely beautiful. She was just stunning. And everybody loved her.
Working at Harper's Magazine, the vivacious mother of two makes friends easily. Maggie Bloomfield was one.
She had a very generous spirit and a very loving heart, and I don't think there was anybody who didn't like her.
Like so many before her, Diane came to New York City to escape the past and find a sparkling future.
We were both from Midwest, small towns, dying to get out, wanting to go to the big city and be rich and famous.
When I arrived in New York, I met many women like Diane. They lived the real life, sex, and the city. Sassy, smart, and ready for anything. A lust for life that could lead to trouble.
After 10 years on the New York party circuit, Diane Peichel ends up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there, she meets her husband, Joe Peichel, a Wall Street guy, stock analyst, money man, net worth in the multi-millions.
He was incredibly smart, and he made a great deal of money. She was at the point, I think, where she wanted stability, and she wanted a wealthy husband.
How are we doing, honey?
She was vulnerable. And he was successful.
We're looking good, babe.
Did we get richer overnight?
Sure did.
And they met in a very kind of faded way.
Apartment in Greenwich Village. House in the Hamptons. Two children in the exclusive Grace Church private school. Joe Peichel delivers the New York dream that Diane has always craved.
You're the wife of a very wealthy man. You're going out to dinner at good restaurants. The 80s were a lot of fun for women like that. This was the kind of couple that would waltz into a restaurant and you'd envy them.
I think ultimately she liked having money. Who doesn't?
By Monday, October 26, 1987, no one has seen Diane for 2 days.
What can I do for you?
She's officially missing.
Tell us the whole story.
And police question her husband, Joe, for any clues to her whereabouts.
Well, simple. It's like any family. You know, we had an argument a couple of days ago, and she stormed out of the house.
He last saw her on Saturday night at their weekend home in Amagansett, Long Island.
First of all, he told the officers, she just left. She just picked up and left.
He's done this before. She'll be back. What was
they had an argument, and after the argument, he went to sleep at 2:30, and he woke up the next morning, and she was gone. Her bag was there, the cars were there, but she had vanished.
But Joe Pikul sensed the police on edge.
His demeanor was weird, he made strange remarks, and he went and pulled out, of all things, a pair of panties. And he proffered the panties and said, here, you want the dogs to get a good sniff of her? And when they left, they said, this isn't a grieving husband. This is somebody who doesn't like his wife. They just knew there was something fishy about him.
Police follow the trail to the Hamptons, the unofficial playground of New York society. Beachfront estates that sell for tens of millions.
The Pikuls own a summer home by the ocean in Amagansett. The perfect getaway from the stress of making millions on Wall Street. Now, police want to know what really happened that night in the Hamptons.
Meanwhile, investigators discover that all is not well in the opulent marriage of Joe and Diane Pikul.
So, madam is finally home.
Where is the babysitter?
I sent her home.
Joe and Diane had had an increasingly turbulent relationship.
It is the first time.
Fighting all the time, upping the stakes of the fights.
And the last.
Diane Pikul's circle of friends are growing more concerned about her disappearance.
Not in some sleazy bar flirting with.
They tell police about the real Joe Pikul.
I will be going to my Pilates class.
A very fraught, complex character. Many, many inner demons. A very controlling, paranoid character. His way of dealing with things was violence.
If I find you're cheating on me.
I think he was a deeply, deeply disturbed, troubled guy.
I will kill you.
When Diane married Joe in 1978, she quickly had 2 children. But this career girl doesn't want to give up the New York dream. She wants to become a top writer.
You are insane.
That is not how Joe sees the mother of his children.
She was terrified. He had a history. He had a history of hurting women, of threatening women.
By 1986, she and Joe are not getting along. They begin seeing a marriage counselor. Then, Diane makes a discovery that any wealthy wife would dread. Her husband has a secret apartment. What she finds inside is shocking.
He had a secret apartment where he was hooking up with guys and cross-dressing.
Joe is a cross-dresser with a taste for illicit sex with men.
Diane did find recordings of his prancing around in women's clothes with a dildo.
Joe Pikul had this alternate personality, this alter ego of Chloe, he called himself. He was a very bizarre individual.
When Wall Street millionaire Joe Pikul became a Chloe, he liked to videotape himself. On one tape, his wife Diane sees him reading the Wall Street Journal, wearing a wedding dress, while pleasuring himself to the tune of, what else? Here comes the bride.
Armed with scandalous evidence of Joe's bisexuality, Diane pushes for a divorce. Then, on October 28th, 3 days after Diane's disappearance, workers on the New York State Thruway make a horrible discovery.
They saw a green tarp, probably a tarp to a vehicle, and it had some rope wrapped around it. Thruway workers cut the canvas and observed 2 feet with ladies' black stockings on, at which time they realized that they had a body.
Diane Peichel is no longer a missing person. When police question Wall Street money man Joe Peichel about his missing wife, Diane, he shrugs it off and offers up a pair of her panties for the search dogs.
No, that won't be necessary, sir.
So when Diane's body turns up on the edge of the New York State Thruway, the cops don't waste any time.
In a homicide like this, the first suspects are usually somebody associated with the family.
Sergeant Joe Tripodo of the New York State Police sees all kinds of people in his line of work. He's never forgotten the night he met Joe Peichel.
On that 29th of October, I had been assigned to the State Police Barracks in Newburgh. Two investigators from Long Island had brought Joe Peichel up under arrest for the murder of Diane Peichel.
Joe Peichel is polite and quietly spoken, not the aggressive Manhattan banker police expect. Then it comes time to identify his wife's body in the morgue. Slipping on his jacket, he coldly mutters, "Let's go see the stiff."
Joe Peichel already has police unsettled.
Look, in all honesty, detective.
They haven't seen anything yet.
After he was arrested, as a normal course of business, we photograph him in his entirety.
Look, you have my confession, but I'm not taking my clothes off, man.
To make sure that he's got all of his injuries are photographed.
Get off me.
In this particular case, when we did that, he was discovered to have the bra and the panties on.
Officers of the New York State Police meet Chloe, Joe's more feminine side. If only Joe's many surprises stopped there.
He said that she was an evil and malicious person and that everybody was better off without her. And with that, he winked at me.
Joe then makes an admission. He killed Diane by strangling her. Why? He says she was blackmailing him into a divorce. Police soon discover more disturbing details. Joe's children were in his Hamptons holiday home when he killed their mother. The next morning, he took them on a family road trip from hell.
He had bought all this plastic sheeting and rope and wrapped the body, put it in the back of the station wagon, put the children in the back seat.
Where are we going?
Peichel spent the best part of that weekend driving around with Diane Peichel's body wrapped in a tarp in the back of his station wagon.
Where should you go without her car?
He couldn't find a good location to dump the body.
I don't know.
The weekend was dragging on, and it was now, I think, into a Sunday.
And he began to be worried that the body was going to smell.
So Joe Peichel comes back down the thruway and I think as a last-ditch effort to get rid of the body, stops on the side of the thruway and throws the body over this hill, this knoll.
It was so unthinkable. It's like, it was just preposterous.
It shows that Joe Peichel was a desperate man, that he really hadn't thought anything out.
Out on bail, awaiting his murder trial, and with his wife barely in the grave, Joe marries one of the mothers from his children's exclusive private school,
Soon after, Joe's new bride tells police he tried to attack her with a knife. Then they both appear on a morning TV talk show to explain the incident. She says that early in any relationship, there is a period of adjustment. Think of it as Joe's idea of a honeymoon.
On December 21st, 1987, Joe Pikul goes on trial for the murder of his wife in Orange County, New York State. He's supremely confident. After all, he has money on his side.
Did he feel he was above the law as a very wealthy man? Absolutely. He was clearly a rich man who could hire big deal lawyers and win and win and win.
But Joe isn't on Wall Street now. Attorneys in upstate New York aren't fazed by his fancy Manhattan lawyers.
You know what? Number one, you're in my town. Number two, whether I'm a hick or I'm not a hick, you did something wrong. The evidence is there. We can prove that you did something wrong. You can pay as much money as you want for as high-priced an attorney as you want to pay, and the result's still going to be the same.
But this is Joe Pikul. You never know what's up his sleeve.
He changed his story somewhat when he got on the stand himself.
It was self-defense.
You bastard!
He tried to paint Diane Pikul as the perpetrator of the incident and how he was just the victim.
She dropped a knife.
His contention is they get into a fight and she comes after him with a knife. He came up with this incredible scenario of how she died of strangulation as an accident.
I tried to get the knife from her, you know? And...
Let go of me! Let go!
I thought that was a stretch, to say the least.
Joe is Wall Street gone seriously awry. He thinks he's a master of the universe, able to outsmart and outspend anyone. Forensic science isn't so easily swayed.
The autopsy showed bashes to the head with an instrument and both manual and ligature strangulation, that means by the hands and by a rope.
Where have you been?
I had some things to do.
Oh, I'm sure you did, you slut.
We believe that the murder of Diane Pikul was a gruesome event, no question about it. I'm sure she was very scared. It definitely was not an instantaneous event. And for whatever that short period of time was, whether it was minutes, whether it was seconds, I'm sure the nightmarish thoughts that went through Diane Pikul's mind were just horrendous. We were not going to let this man use his wealth, power, position to get away with murder.
A moneyed marriage worthy of the social pages ends in murder. How did it come to this?
Greed. He didn't want to pay her any money. He didn't want to have to go through the cost and expense of a divorce. And he wanted his kids. He murdered an innocent woman and left two beautiful children without parents.
He was a sociopath, and he was a drug addict and an alcoholic. So you put all those together, and the test tube came up with this monster.
It's extremely difficult not to come to the conclusion that Joe is a serious, deranged individual.
The jury finds him guilty.
This was a jury that looked at the parade of evidence and said, he did it.
And it seemed like he spent a lot of money for not a good result.
Joe Pikul, man of millions, is guilty of murder.
Of course, Joe being Joe, there's always another secret lurking in the darkness. It turns out that he is HIV positive. He dies of complications from AIDS before he can even be sentenced.
And when that happens, at least in the state of New York, your conviction is vacated. That means no conviction. He was a desperate, disturbed, angry, somewhat psychotic man, hated his wife, knew he was dying, kept it a secret, knew he could die, and wanted to kill her so she would not get the children.
Joe Pykel left nothing but bitterness and bad memories with the people he encountered. But the wife he killed is remembered in quite a different light.
We just always had fun together. We made each other laugh. And that's my most precious memory, is how we would laugh together. Every time I go to the beach, I talk to her. I go down to the beach and I talk to her often.
Still to come, behind mansion walls. When you're married to the Miami high life,
a substantial amount of cocaine, and it could be a trafficking amount of cocaine,
you better watch your back.
When you have a lot of money and you're a powerful person, you always have enemies.
Or you might just lose a husband.
The movie Scarface wasn't too far off the mark.
Sunny Miami, Florida, where the wealthy retired go to live out their days peacefully in the land of sand and sun. They hope. In the 1980s, God's waiting room is a little busier than normal. Miami Nice becomes Miami Vice.
It was a town with too much money, too many drugs, too many people who played by no rules at all.
The cocaine cowboys rule Miami. $11 billion a year is washing through the city. Everyone is getting rich. And where drugs and money go, murder is sure to follow.
There were a lot of people in town with a lot of money. And a lot of that money was connected to drug import. There's no question about it. That had a number of consequences. One of them was big houses, lavish lifestyles. The movie Scarface wasn't too far off the mark.
The cocaine money drives a building boom, and Stan Cohen is poised to cash in. 52-year-old Stan runs a multi-million-dollar construction business, wheeling and dealing in Miami's exploding property market.
He had amassed quite a bit of property. He had a ranch in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. They were avid skiers. He owned a jet plane. He owned a yacht, and he owned this lovely home.
His other plaything is a young bride, Joyce Cohen. 17 years Stan's junior, Joyce used to be a secretary. He swept her off her feet to become a trophy wife. His fourth.
Joyce came to Miami from the Midwest. She was pretty, but a bit of a plain Jane. No makeup, no jewelry. People described her as vanilla. A few giant shopping sprees with Stan Cohen's credit cards would certainly change all that.
She needed and wanted the fancy cars, the jewelry, the furs, the expensive clothing.
She drove a Jaguar. She could buy whatever it was she wanted. She had all the designer clothes. She went to all the right hangouts.
And if you're young, rich, and beautiful in Miami, you like to party like there's no tomorrow.
She liked the party scene. She liked the party life. Late night, clubs, lots of cocaine, Lots of champagne, lots of drugs around.
Late night parties would often ring out from here. Stan and Joyce's stylish mansion. It presides over the glamorous neighborhood of Coconut Grove.
It's a large house up on a bluff. There's a very commanding view. It's a very interesting and imposing house with a lot of character.
But on March 7th, 1986, the Coens' wonderful home becomes a madhouse.
Dozens of police officers, dozens of crime scene technicians combing the area. Police officers outside, cordoning off the neighborhood, keeping people out.
And I looked up at that house on the bluff and I thought, people who lived there had this wonderful, lovely, charming life. What could possibly have gone wrong in that beautiful house?
Sex, drugs, lies, and murder. That's what went wrong in that beautiful house.
Joyce Cohen was hysterical, so all she said was, I heard shooting.
That morning, Joyce Cohen is up early, preparing for a garage sale.
What she heard was gunshots, and then she heard people coming down the stairs of this two-story home. She heard what she thought was a Latin-accented male talking to another, let's get out of here.
And then she glimpsed men wearing dark clothing, running back downstairs and fleeing out the front door.
She immediately ran upstairs to find her husband, Stan.
Stan?
Lying in bed.
No!
Having been shot.
No!
Blood gushing from his wounds.
Stan Cohen has been shot in the back 4 times. He's slowly bleeding to death. When police arrive, they soon discover that all may not be well in the marriage of Stan and Joyce Cohen.
The detective sort of smelt it. There may be a problem.
Downstairs when I first heard
she was in her own bedroom, which is always an indication that there's trouble in paradise.
Stan Cohen's money transformed Joyce's life into a luxurious dream. But it could never change their 17-year age difference. At age 52, Stan has a mild heart attack. Time for him to slow down. Trouble is, his young bride has no intention of doing the same.
New shoes.
I got these weeks ago. This is new.
Joyce began to spend more and more time without Stanley.
Don't hit it too hard tonight.
Yes, Father.
Stanley would be home in bed. Joyce would be out and about.
I was downstairs when I first heard her shoes.
And why were you downstairs?
At the crime scene, one detective asks a pointed question.
Can I ask, Mrs. Cohen, when was the last time that you and your husband had sex?
That's it.
It's a standard.
I'm not talking to you anymore.
It's a standard.
All of you get out of my house. All of you get out of my house.
This was the first time the widow said, get out of my house. That has never happened before or since.
And Joyce?
Get out!
Won't let them back in without a search warrant.
Get out!
That was the first hint that we had that maybe there would be more to the story.
Joyce Cohen's attorney, Alan Ross, says she had a very good reason to keep the police out. She might be charged over Miami's number one vice.
I'm being asked to have a client sign a consent to search under circumstances where I'm told there's likely going to be cocaine found in the house, and I had a suspicion that it may be a substantial amount of cocaine, and it could be a trafficking amount of cocaine.
While police are locked out of the house waiting for a search warrant, an officer checks the garden.
In the front of the house under a tree, a gun was found, turned out to be the murder weapon.
Detective, over here.
It's a .38 caliber revolver, and it belongs to the victim, Stanley Cohen.
Good job, officer.
The fingerprint technician said this was wiped down. It was nice and smooth. There were no fingerprints on it.
Under the hammer of the gun is found a very small speck, and I mean the tiniest of specks,
of tissue paper. And when police finally get inside, they make another discovery.
In Joyce Cohen's bathroom, a very significant piece of evidence was found. An ordinary facial tissue.
It's more than just a tissue. It's a huge break.
There's no getting around that tissue. That was critical, powerful scientific evidence.
Miami, in the mid-80s. Cocaine keeps the party going, and the cops busy.
We averaged well over 600 homicides a year in those days. It's a lot of murders, and most of them were drug-related.
At first glance, the shooting of millionaire Stan Cohen looks like just another home invasion.
Total stranger comes in, looks to do a robbery. The victim wakes up, gets shot. It's a big house in a nice neighborhood, and you figure a burglar might break into a house like that.
I was there with you.
Stan's young wife, Joyce, says she heard gunshots and intruders.
She heard one say to someone else, "Let's get out of here." She saw shadowy figures run out of the house.
Shadowy figures in the darkness. In Miami, in those days, shadowy figures abound, especially in the colorful world of Stanley Cohen.
Stanley had many enemies. When you have a lot of money and you're a powerful person and you're running around town, everybody knows you, you always have enemies.
It was a rough and tumble world in Miami and the business that he was in, and that was the construction business.
Stanley's attorney of 30 years said, "I had a list of those enemies, all of whom had the means and the motive to kill Stanley."
But will a small shred of tissue paper tell the real story?
This was the critical evidence. Everyone thought this was the heart of the case.
A tissue found in Joyce Cohen's bathroom seems to match tiny tissue pieces stuck to the murder weapon. Was it used to wipe prints off the gun?
Forensic scientists find three things on that tissue: traces of makeup, gunpowder residue, and nasal mucus, which matches the blood type of Joyce Cohen.
So you had this piece of evidence that was pretty damning. It's associated with her, it's associated with a woman, and it contains gunshot residue.
And as for the motive, investigators say it's something very familiar in marriages of the wealthy.
Do you think I'm stupid?
The threat of losing a life of glamour through divorce.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I don't want to go to bed at 9:30 like an old person.
I almost died, you bitch.
One of Stan's very good friends, his accountant, testified to Stan and met with him and shared with him his intention and design to divorce Joyce.
Joyce told her friends that Stanley had said to her, "If we get divorced, you're going out of this marriage the same way you came in.
With nothing."
But prosecutors don't think they have enough evidence to make an arrest. Joyce Cohen goes free, but Stan Cohen's children from a previous marriage freeze his assets. For Joyce, the Miami high life is over.
Joyce was penniless. For the first time since she had married Stanley Cohen, she was penniless. She had nowhere to live. She didn't have a car. She didn't have anything.
Nearly 3 years after her husband's murder, the undisputed party queen of Coconut Grove is living in exile. Home is now a trailer park in Chesapeake, Virginia. That's where police find her to announce a breakthrough in the case. She's under arrest.
Back in Miami, career criminal Frank Zuccarello has been busted for a series of violent home invasions. Facing a long prison stretch, he makes an astounding confession.
Frank Zuccarello told the investigators that he knew about the Cohen murder because he had been contacted as a possible hitman. He claimed that Joyce Cohen had gotten in touch with two other men to help kill her husband.
Okay. Frank, weren't you here by this door?
She would set up the scene, and then they could stage a phony break-in, come into the house, and murder her husband and leave.
The link to Frank Zuccarello comes through one of Joyce Cohen's Miami cocaine connections. A fellow party girl from Coconut Grove.
Can you imagine me going back to Miami?
Joyce mentioned that she was afraid of getting divorced and losing all the money and wanted him dead.
You serious? Yeah.
And did she know anybody? And according to Frank Zuccarello, there were some meetings and she promised them $20,000 if they would kill him.
Joyce goes on trial for murder. Frank's confession, combined with the tissue paper evidence, convince a jury that Joyce Cohen ordered her husband's death.
She wanted the money. She didn't want to lose her lifestyle. And she picked the wrong people to do it.
Joyce Cohen was living in a bubble provided by her husband's wealth and status and privilege. When Stanley Cohen was murdered, Joyce's bubble burst in every conceivable way. His wealth could not protect her. If she thought she might get away with murder, she was wrong.
From Coconut Grove to the trailer park, and then to prison with a life sentence, marriage to money took Joyce Cohen on a roller coaster ride. But it doesn't end there. There's another side to the tale of Joyce Cohen.
There was more to this story than just a domestic problem between husband and wife resulting in a shooting.
Today, Joyce Cohen is prisoner number 161701 in Lowell Correctional Institution, Florida. She's serving a life sentence for ordering a hit on her husband, Stan.
Talk to most prisoners, rich or poor, and they'll try to convince you they're innocent. Joyce Cohen still swears two intruders killed her husband. The police and a jury didn't believe her. But to this day, there are others who do.
We spoke for maybe an hour, and I asked her specifically, did you kill your husband? She said no.
Former TV reporter Gail Bright Doerr visited Joyce in prison.
The one thing I remembered is she said, if I wanted his money, I could have just divorced him. I didn't have to kill him, and I didn't kill him.
Cohen's defense attorney, Alan Ross, also stands by his client.
I think there's a completely understandable explanation for how all of the physical evidence existed that's consistent with innocence.
That evidence is a white tissue found in Joyce's bathroom. On it was gunpowder residue, makeup, and her mucus.
Joyce Cohen ran upstairs after hearing gunshots, excited, alarmed, disturbed, to find her husband shot in bed.
No!
She immediately attended to him. She's touching the body. She's touching his head. She's placing a towel up against the bloody wounds in the back of his head. She would necessarily have had gunshot residue transferred to her hands because there's gunshot residue all over Stan Cohen.
No, I don't know. His head is completely covered.
She's sniffling, she's crying. She takes tissue, she goes to the bathroom.
Not surprisingly, prosecuting attorney David Waxman sees it differently.
The tissue paper in her bathroom contained gunpowder, her mucus, tears in it. That was the end of her. I mean, there was no getting around that. Unless a little green man from Mars came down and put it in her waste paper basket, that was critical, powerful scientific evidence.
But there's still the inconvenient story of local criminal turned snitch, Zuccarello. He claims Joyce hired him and two others to kill her husband. In exchange for his testimony, Zuccarello gets an early release from a long stretch in jail. Was that incentive enough to invent the entire tale?
I brought the map.
His accomplices, who he claimed did the actual shooting, weren't so lucky. Both denied having anything to do with the killing. But they were already in prison for home invasion robberies. When Zuccarello put them in the hot seat, they were in no position to bargain.
All right.
They originally said they didn't know anything about it, and then they were offered some kind of deal, a lesser sentence for cooperating and saying that, yes, they too were there. However, now they absolutely still deny that they were there.
I'm convinced they never met Joyce Cohen. I'm convinced they wouldn't know where Stan Cohen's house was in a million years. They were never there. It's just a story that was told, and frankly, it's hard to tell why the jury convicted in this case.
It all begs the question, if Joyce Cohen didn't want her husband dead, who did?
An enemy from the construction business is one theory. Others allege that Stan Cohen was making money off the biggest business in town, cocaine.
One of the things we had heard was that Stan Cohen had been involved in using his own private jet for the purpose of helping drug dealers launder their proceeds and get their money out of the country. So, you know, where goes drugs, where goes money laundering? Death sometimes is soon to follow. It's a dangerous business.
Whoever killed Stan Cohen, the motive remains the same. Money. Whether it's a marriage vow or a business deal, when millions are at stake, the hand of greed is never far from pushing someone to murder.
I was completely convinced, as I am today, that Joyce is innocent of this murder. She had nothing to do with it.
I attended the trial. I interviewed everyone who would speak to me. I interviewed some of the jurors. I interviewed Mrs. Cohen. My belief, having the benefit of all this research, is that Joyce Cohen was culpable. She was culpable in the murder of her husband.
I think this woman may well be innocent and may be spending the rest of her life in jail for a murder she didn't commit.
For richer or poorer, for better or worse, who can tell at the altar which it will be? Diane Peichel was dazzled by the New York high life, then consumed by its dark side, while Joyce Cohen married into money and a life in prison. These husbands and wives aspired to glamorous lives. Money made their dreams come true until murder had the final say. Till next we meet, behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.